what does a perfect world look like? What would it be like? Have you ever imagined a perfect world where people actually were at peace with themselves? They understood that we were connected to something greater than that. Is that Christina Apodaca? I'm just like, hi, Christina. She's up from Las Cruces, and she's part of our board, and she's here. The surprise is today. Anyway, you might hear the word "and." You might hear the word "anyway" throughout the talk. And it's about loving ourselves unconditionally. Now, a perfect world would be a place where we were healthy, we got along, we had peace in the world. What else would be a part of a perfect world? Everything was free. Or we had a bartering system, and it was just a good world. And yet, here's the truth. We live in an imperfect world with imperfect people, including ourselves. And yet, I strive, and I would imagine all of us strive, to be perfect, to say the right thing, to do the right thing, to be good, whatever that is, to be what you would like to be, because I believe we all fall down. We all fail, do we not? To say the right thing, to do the right thing. And then the question is, how do you feel about yourself when you could have done something and you didn't, or you did something and wish you hadn't? We all have had times where we've made mistakes, we've fallen down, we've screwed up, we've said the wrong thing. And how do you feel about yourself when you do that? Shame. You don't feel good about yourself. And the thing is we were born, we all had the experience of being born. Every one of us, including those folks that we don't like and that seem mean and terrorists and all kinds of things, born innocent children. Innocent babies. What happens to those innocent little sweet babies? Well, Don Miguel Ruiz says we get domesticated. And that's the Adventures in Faith study we did last fall. He talks about how we come into the world and our parents are imperfect. Our world is imperfect. And when I say imperfect, I also want to include the word wounded, because we all get hurt. And then we make up ideas about people and things, and we get belief systems built from what we encounter. We're told as a society and from our parents what it means to be good, what's right and what's wrong, what's good and what's bad. And we follow the rules as usually, because otherwise we get punished when we don't follow the rules. We get rewarded when we follow the rules. And so we have this natural way of wanting to be perfect, to do it right. Anybody like say, I want to do things really screwed up today. I want to make a mess of things. I want to say the wrong thing. I want to do the wrong thing. I don't want to do anything that I'm supposed to do. None of us wake up in the morning, you know, people that are abusive, they wake up in the morning and go, gosh, I'd really like to abuse my kid today. I don't think that that is what happens. They're usually people that hurt people are hurting themselves. They're already in pain. They don't know a healthy way to express or be with the pain. And they're probably doing maybe what had been in their background as their small child self. So we have this tendency to want to be perfect. Now, why I'm talking about all this, because the gifts of imperfection talk about this thing about imperfect and what happens when we're not perfect. Anyone have an inner critic? Okay. Like, what's my dad had this wonderful thing when I would do something that wasn't to his liking, which was often because I was the rebel. He would say, what's wrong with you? Okay, what's wrong with you? And I internalized that for a long time. Because when I'd screw up, it's like, what's wrong with you? The truth is, nothing is wrong with me. My behavior is very questionable, but we tend to... wasn't supposed to be funny. But see, we put behaviors, the difference between shame and guilt, and I think I spoke of this last week, is guilt is when I had a bad behavior. Shame is when I'm bad. So shame is when I internalize I'm bad. No, it's guilt. My behavior was questionable, perhaps bad. It's like, who decides what's good and bad, right? So we're dealing with judgment. We're dealing with our own inner critic. And that's what we're going to talk about today, one of the parts of the gifts of imperfection. Brené Brown has 10 guideposts of how to live the imperfect life and to learn how to embrace who you are and love yourself 100% of the time unconditionally. What do you do with the inner critic who wants to beat us up and tell us you're stupid, you're dumb, how could you do that, what's wrong with you? We get that. We have that. There isn't anybody who hasn't got part of that. And we all tend to strive to be perfect. When I first started reading the guidepost number 2 about letting go of perfectionism, I thought, yeah, I'm not really into perfectionism. I love myself even when I screw up. But then I started to think about it. If somebody comes over to your house and it's a disaster area, you haven't cleaned your house and you feel a little embarrassed, or do you go, oh, come on in, I'm just a big old slob and it's okay, I just named what I was, I'm a slob. My behavior is, I was lazy and I don't care to clean. So we do get embarrassed. We want to do good. We want to be right. And when we're not, we have shame. We feel bad about ourselves. We beat ourselves up. The remedy for that is to let go of perfectionism. Good luck with that. And here's the thing. What we want and need is compassion. Self-compassion. Oh, what a concept, right? So let's see where we're at here. Not that page. I'm not going to be perfect. Just saying. I don't need to be perfect. So she talks about how we talk to ourselves. And you can have healthy striving. So she talks about how body image, weight, you know. We all perhaps have had the world tell us you're a little chubby there. You got, what's that roll, you know, looking like a cinnamon roll. And so I can go, nothing fits. I don't have the willpower. I'm bad. I'm wrong. Or I'm going to do this and I'm going to move into that expression. You can have healthy striving, but there is a difference. And as Jerry Ryan puts it, he looks to have occasional excellence. I'm going to have occasional excellence. It's a very loving way to talk about and to yourself. The difference between people that are experiencing more shame and perfectionism and those that have moved out of that is that those that have the wholehearted living are talking to themselves with tenderness, understanding, and compassion. And they're slow to judge themselves or others. There's a professor, and you know, there's a lot of professors in the world. There's actually, she's a Dr. Kristen Neff at the University of Texas at Austin runs the Self-Compassion Research Lab. Who knew? And she came up with 3 components of self-compassion. One is self-kindness. To be kind and understanding to ourselves when we mess up, when we fail or feel inadequate, we are kind to ourselves. I like the phrase, be gentle. be gentle with yourself, be gentle with myself. Because I wasn't for a long part of my life. Common humanity, to realize that you're not the only one that may be struggling with anything. There's a common humanity. That's part of the self-compassion too. I'm not the only one who has messed up in this way. I'm not the only one. And the other one is mindfulness. And that is taking a balanced approach to negative emotions. Because when we have negative emotions, we don't want to exaggerate them or suppress them. We want to be balanced in the expression of painful emotions, feeling vulnerable or shame. And not to over-identify with the feeling. Example, I'm depressed. Or I feel depressed. I have been very mindful and working on my mindfulness because it's easy to say, I'm depressed, I'm sad, I'm mad, I'm upset. And the thing is we're saying I am. Whenever we say I am, it's claiming that is who I am. That's the identity. I am sad, I am mad, I am depressed. Or, and I've had to work on this personally, is to say the word feel. When I want to say I'm depressed, it's so easy. It's natural to kind of want to go there. I'm working on my own language to say, I feel depressed. I feel upset. It's a feeling. It's not who I am. So that's a radical piece of difference. This, by the way, Dr. Neff also has a self-compassion scale. And you can go to selfcompassion.org and find out just how self-kind, mindful, or the common humanity you tend to be in. It'll kind of give you some insight as to your own level of self-compassion and how, and she's got tons of things about how to increase your self-love and compassion. I was impressed, very much so, and glad that Brené Brown had pointed that out. So selfcompassion.org, check it out. So to embrace and to have more self-compassion, I'm going to share with you one way to do that. Would you like to know what it is?
Yes.
Okay. She's ready. Okay. So when I would eat a gallon of ice cream, no, I didn't have any eating issues. I did attend Overeaters Anonymous for some point in my life because I was very much addicted to food and using food. When I would eat all this ice cream, then I could really feel good about myself, right? I could really beat myself up for that behavior. It's like, oh, the nasties of myself. However, Spirit taught me to do this. I gave myself a hug. I love you anyway. I love me anyway. I love me anyway. Okay, so we're going to practice this because it's not just words. So I bet you all can think of at least one thing where you kind of screwed up and you wish you hadn't done something. Okay, when you have that in your mind, I want you to put your hands like this. There's always something that you wish you had done differently. Think about that now. You don't have to use my name, but use your own name. Or actually, let's say, I love me anyway. Go ahead. I love me anyway. Again, I love me anyway. And one more time, I love me anyway. Okay. I love me anyway. I screwed up. I made a mistake. I got in an accident. I did something really brainless, it seemed. But I'm a human. I make mistakes. I'm going to mess up. I love me anyway. All right. So self-compassion is a key. One of the keys for all of us to embrace and let the, what she calls it, the gremlins, the inner gremlins, whatever term that is for that inner critic. Thank you so much for sharing. You're excused, I tell the inner gremlins. So self-compassion, when we mess up, we're going to mess up. There's no doubt about it. But you're not a mess, okay? You make a mistake. You're not a mistake. We need to own and understand that. So self-compassion is huge in our journey to wholehearted living, especially when things go awry in our lives and in the world. We have a crazy world, yes? A very crazy world. We have things like death, disasters. We have relationships that don't work well. We have abuse, self-abuse sometimes. We have a lot of heavy things in our world. We have racism and killings and all kinds of things. And how do we personally manage to be up, to bounce back, so to speak? To be resilient is the word. To be able to rise up after terrible things have happened. We all have had times where we have suffering and pain and sadness and grief and fears. How do we have resilience? Now, of course, there's research about every topic on earth. And one of the things, Brené Brown being such the research queen, I'll call her, she looked at other studies. And so resilient people have five things in common. Number one, they are resourceful and they problem solve. Resilient people are willing to ask for help. They're willing to understand that I can actually do something to help myself with my situation or my fears. And to have connections with family and friends, and also to have resources and networks. For instance, the AA groups and OA groups and any of that is a resource. However, she also found in all of her interviews with these wholehearted folks, and that was that she found one other thing that seemed to be in common that wasn't in the, quote, research. And that one thing, want to know what it is? It's their spirituality. She talks about the spirituality, and it's not religion, and it's not dogma. I love that she put together this this definition of spirituality. One thing I'd love for you all to do is, sometime today, this week, what's your definition of spirituality? She writes and wrote, spirituality is recognizing and celebrating that we are all we're all connected to one another by a power greater than all of us, and that our connection to that power and to one another is grounded in love and compassion. Practicing spirituality brings a sense of perspective, meaning, and purpose to our lives. It's celebrating and recognizing that we're connected to a power greater than ourselves, and that that power is love. It is compassion. Without exception, spirituality, the belief in connection, a power greater than self, and interconnections grounded in love and compassion, emerged as a component of resilience. Most people spoke of God, but not everyone. Some were occasional churchgoers, others not at all. Some worshiped at fishing holes, others in temples, mosques, or at home. Some struggled with the idea of religion, and some were devout members of organized religions. The one thing that they all had in common was spirituality was the foundation of their resilience. And so she goes on and she talks about there are three components of spirituality. The first one is hope. Okay, to have hope. Because when you're in having no hope, that's probably the lowest, when you don't even have hope. And she talks about hope, and she said, hope is not an emotion. And I thought, she was kind of puzzled by that. Because we think being hopeful, you have a feeling that things are going to work out, right? She said, actually, hope is cognitive. And I totally buy that, because what we believe is what we feel. And her idea is that when we have hope, we have the idea that I have a goal. I would like to feel better. I would like to do better. I would like to have something better in my life. So there's a goal. And then there's some idea of how you can get there with some flexibility. And the last part, she says, and you believe in yourself. Now, I actually disagree a little bit with Brené's thing about believing in ourselves. I do believe it's helpful to have hope that I believe in myself. But there are times where our behavior and where we are in life, we may not believe in ourselves. You know, folks that hit the bottom in any way, shape, or form. I believe that belief in yourself is important, but believing that there is something greater than myself. That's what gets me through. That's what gives me hope. One of my teachers, Mary Morrissey, said that she believed that she had this, not in the book, Liz. It's like, I'll go to the book. No, Mary Morrissey did not jump into the book. Anyway, so spirit within us, there's a power far greater than any situation, circumstance, or condition in your life. It's also greater than any fear, doubt, or worry you have. That's what I have my faith in, is that there is a power. And when you have something that is so big, you can say, or some situation, you know, great spirit is greater than the conflict in the Middle East or in my life. It is greater than. And I choose to believe that to be so. I think that is one of the biggest keys to hope and resilience. She also talks about a second component called cultivating your mindfulness. How many of you see ads every single day in some way, shape, or form? We're inundated, bombarded with all this information about what's the best life ever. We get pictures of what the perfect life is. And you think, oh, it doesn't affect me. I don't believe that. I believe it affects us subconsciously. That doesn't affect me, all those ads. I don't believe that. And yet, it is subconscious. It affects us. So to have a reality check of the expectations that you may have or that you've bought into about what it looks like to be the best. Question that. The last part that she has about this idea of resilience stemming from the spiritual nature of our being. How many of you like to feel pain? Nobody's hand went up. Oh, okay. Nobody likes to feel pain, sadness, grief, despair, disappointment. I'm not signing up for any of those. And yet we live in a world where these emotions and feelings are going to happen. There's loss. There's things that happen. And what do you do when you have painful feelings? Well, numbing. We have behaviors that we use to avoid our feelings. And I'm going to tell you something. It is not wrong or bad to have numbing feelings. It is natural to use things to avoid our feelings. However, when it gets out of hand, that's when you need to perhaps pay attention. How many things that we do to numb? Alcohol, drugs, edibles, you know, we have tons of ways, shopping, working, caregiving, staying busy, planning. I don't want to feel my feelings. So I find all these things. That makes me think of the Pink Floyd line of comfortably numb, you know, smoking some pot. I'm good, right? We avoid feeling our feelings. And it's interesting that I'm doing a grief recovery class right now, and we're talking about STIRBs. What's a STIRB? It's a short-term energy relieving behavior. It's about how I can't feel that much pain. So there's nothing bad about my eating all that ice cream. However, it can become an addiction. There is a line between using things. And here's what the key is. It's called being mindful of your feelings. That I am using that because I don't really want to feel sad. My wife passed in December of last year. I have used those STIRBs on many different occasions, watching TV. And it's not about escape. The question is, do I know that I'm using that? I'm actually choosing to feel my sadness more than I would care to. I'd rather be numbed out. I have so many ways I can numb out. However, I want to be living the wholehearted way. And that means I want to feel my feelings. I want to cry. I hate crying because it makes my nose stuffed up and my eyes get all red. I don't like crying. And I'm going to cry instead of numbing out. It's my choice. It's all our choice. It's not bad or wrong when I do numb out. Sometimes I have a fantasy person that I think about them and they're my happy thought person. And yes, I'm avoiding maybe feeling the sadness of missing my wife. And that's okay. It's not bad or wrong. And I'm going to reiterate it. It's not bad or wrong to numb. It's when does it become too much? The questions that she asked, she said, I'm convinced that we all numb and take the edge off. The question is, does our eating, drinking, spending, gambling, saving the world, gossiping, perfectionism, 60-hour work week get in the way of our authenticity? Does it stop us from being emotionally honest and setting boundaries and feeling like we're enough? Does it keep us from staying out of judgment and to feel connected? Am I using something to hide or escape from the reality of my life? What I know is when I numb part of my life, my painful feelings, I also numb my joy. You can't numb selectively. The question is, are we willing to go, yes, I'm numbing right now. And that's okay, not to judge yourself. And what would it be like to just feel, the sad? Call somebody and cry. Feel the feelings, the shame, be vulnerable, be willing to share. That's what she talks about. We can rise up from anything. We can be resilient. Spirituality, having hope, being mindful, and also just to recognize when I'm using and I need a hug. That's the question that I ask myself when I'm wanting to numb out. What would I really like instead? I'd like a partner. Thank you so much. You know, I'd like a hug. I'd like a conversation with somebody. I'm feeling lonely. I don't mind being alone, but I don't necessarily like being lonely, and I miss my person. That's the truth. And yet I'm rising up in spite of it all. We can rise up because there's something greater than our situations, our circumstances, and conditions. So I'm going to know that we are choosing to rise up together now and in all the days to come. Because we are resilient and we are compassionate with ourselves. And so it is.